Good evening and welcome to the latest episode and the inaugural episode of The Three Horsemen, our fill-in show for the past two episodes on the SF Signal podcast, is now launching separately as its own entity.
Yay.
So be afraid.
Dun, dun, dun.
Be very afraid. Joining me tonight, as usual, are the other two horsemen. Say hello, Jeff Patterson.
Hi, Jeff Patterson here, writer, illustrator, blogger. I have an ebook out called Don't Tweet Where You Eat, available on Kindle. And I'm going to be selling prints at Worldcon this year. So,
excellent.
And say hello to that voice, Mr. John Stevens.
I am that voice. And I am also a SF Signal regular. I'm a blogger, columnist, writer, bon vivant of various sorts. tonight I am a horseman again.
And I'm Fred Kish. I tweet on Twitter, obviously, as Fred Kish, and I blog occasionally at FSA Signal. Not occasionally enough for Mr. John DiNardo, our bagel overlord, but I also blog occasionally at my own site, The Lensman's Children. So tonight, we are going to continue more or less in the same format that we have done the first two shows at, and later on we'll talk about where we're going in the future. We have a couple of subjects for you folks. Since it's August, and a young fan's thoughts turn to San Antonio, we thought we'd talk about the Hugo and other awards. It's Hugo time, folks. So, are awards worth it? Do you think that any are more legitimate than others? And so on and so forth. John? Okay,
me
Jeff.
First, no. Get yourself back here.
Okay.
Are awards legitimate? Are there more legitimate awards than the Hugo? Is that what we're saying here?
Well, I mean,
I just found that the way you phrased that really
yes, yeah,
fascinating, shall we say?
I mean, when the Nebulas were started, which I think was 66,
mm-hmm.
You know, it seemed that it was a different kind of thing because it was your peers were picking you as being the best of the year. Whereas what a lot of people complain about are the Hugos are entirely popularity based.
Right.
There are some people who claim that juried awards are the only quote unquote legitimate awards because
like
you have
fantasy.
You have cool headed professionals, you know, not influenced by any politics or whatever, haha. Picking who the winners are.
Yeah.
So that's a better way of phrasing that question.
Well, I mean, the Hugos are a popularity contest. I mean, but I only partly mean that in a bad way. And I don't know if I can explain that or not. I think I had said earlier tonight on Twitter that I was doing a little background reading for this, and my sort of natural ambivalence about awards came up again as I looked at the Hugo lists and saw really amazing books, what I thought were amazing books, lose out to books that were fine or that were okay, but just weren't for me the strongest work of the year. And, you know, books won that we've never heard from again and books that didn't win that same year have gone on to become classics.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always that, you know, there's always that sort of disjuncture between what gets lauded as the best for a given year and what ends up being something that has enduring power in the reading community.
But you could say the same thing about the Nebulas as well.
You could, and you could say something about, you know, the World Fantasy Awards, Shirley Jackson Awards. I mean, you can say that about almost anything. But then you get to the basis of your, I guess, the basis of what you think is problematic. And, you know, you can, for the Hugos, it's that, you know, it often seems that a book that is popular wins out over a book that is perhaps in some ways more, you know, deeper or better. I'm going to probably catch a lot of flack for this, but if you look at the history of the Hugos, you can see that there's a mixture going on of that kind of, you know, back and forth, I think.
Right.
And so the, you know, the, I don't know if there's really a legitimacy question, so much as a question of, you know, what awards do we feel best reflects, you know, the zeitgeist of the community at a given point, perhaps?
One problem might be that at the time of the award, you know, it might take a couple of years before a book becomes known as reflecting the zeitgeist of the community.
Sure.
I mean, was in 1955, did They Rather Be Right, a.k.a. The Forever Machine by Mark Clifton and Frank Reilly, really reflect science fiction at that time? Sure. I believe Mr. Wolf and Mr. Strawn have brought that title up many times in the past.
Sure. No, and that's, you know, like I said, this is sort of this is where the ambivalence for me comes in, is that my gut instinct is to say that juried prizes, juried awards can potentially, you know, find the more perhaps zeitgeisty title for a given year. But when you look at the history of awards, of any award, you can sort of see there's a mixture of you know, popular and, you know, more artsy or more literary or more highfalutin, however you want to phrase it. So there's no...
Wait. So, what column is it that you write?
I write the highfalutin column. But you know, it was interesting to me to go back over the history of the Hugos and look and see what won for any given year and what lost for any given year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you know, and occasionally go, wait a minute, what book? You know, and the Mark Clifton is one example, but there were a couple of other books that I saw and I thought, what book is that? You know, like I've read a lot of Clifford D. Simak, but I'd never heard of Here Gather the Stars, for example. And when you look at the books that win, like I said, there are a lot of classics that win, and then there's always these little pockets of, you know, books that make you kind of scratch your head.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's always the tension between, you know, what we think is sort of emblematic of the genre and personal preference.
Precisely.
Another ambivalence just gets inserted right there, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, like I said, there were a number of years I looked at and I thought, you know, I read the book that won and a couple of the books that didn't win, and I thought, no. clearly other books were better. But to a certain extent, that's a subjective judgment. What it always comes back to for me is the question of, what are awards for? And what awards are for are a lot of things. They serve a number of functions in the community. You know, they're a prestige thing. They're a ritual, you know, that we like to go through to formalize certain processes of, you know, talk of having essentially a community discussion about what we think are, you know, good books, what, you know, what standards of taste are, you know, what books affect people, how they affect people, and what sort of legacy that the community, depending on which community you're talking about, who makes the award up, wants to put forth for the future. So all those things fold into this kind of discussion.
Any thoughts?
And thus my ambivalence.
How about you, Jeff?
I just realized 2 days ago that the day that I was born in 1962 was when Chi-Con 3 was going on, so I believe I was born the day before Stranger in a Strange Land won Best Novel, I think. It wasn't the day, unless they did the Hugos on a Friday. So
that might explain a lot.
Yes, it does, I think. the one thing that I think awards the service that they perform and the truly legitimate role that they have is, as John mentioned, they really do foster dialogue within the reading community. And to me, like John, I went through and looked at all the nominees and winners over the course of the history, and they do present a really fascinating time capsule to what was going on in the genre at that time, especially when you're, you know, when you're looking back at a world without an internet and a world without the dialogue occurring in venues outside of conventions, which is basically where all this discussion used to happen on a regular basis. An example for me of the kind of impact that has is 1985 when Neuromancer wins. Number one, not only does Neuromancer get lauded for ushering in cyberpunk and a new aesthetic to the genre, but when you look at that year, it was up against David Palmer's Emergence, a book I love, Peace War by Werner Vinge, Job, A Comedy of Justice by Heinlein, and Integral Trees by Larry Niven. And with the possible exception of Job, depending on what your definition of SF is, Neuromancer is probably the least science fictional book out of everything that was nominated. Certainly the least fantastic. And that sort of is showing where, the reading attention was at the time, at least for me. It shows that there really, the sense of wonder was in high gear that particular year, even though Neuromancer, which certainly doesn't fail to deliver a sense of wonder, just not on the magnitude of the other books did. That's all.
But when you look at, it was really funny that you mentioned that, because when I looked at this, I looked at the 80s, and it looked like the 80s, in terms of what won, was almost, with the exception of Neuromancer, kind of a return to a kind of a good old-fashioned science fiction. Yeah, when you look at what won, Startide Rising, Ender's Game,
right,
The Uplift War,
mm-hmm.
And that most of that decade, Down Below Station, there's this whole rash of, relatively, classic science fiction, space opera, big idea SF. And then right in the middle in 1985, Neuromancer comes in.
Yeah.
And sort of hacks into the system there.
Yeah. It's funny because the 80s was the decade that I was really, where I pretty much every single year read every book that was up. And the thing that I found interesting in looking back at the 80s was how my personal taste has changed over the years. I mean, I love Uplift War. I really, really love that book. When it came out, I loved it. I reread it a couple of years ago. I still love it. It won out over When Gravity Fails by Effinger and Earth of the New Sun by Gene Wolfe, which, if that happened today, I might go, ooh! And that was one of those, it really kicked me. And then I think about the 90s, when basically every award went to Louis McMaster Bujold. He dedicated the entire decade to her. But she beat out, Greg Bear's Queen of Angels, which is probably my favorite Greg Bear book. And I was exceedingly happy when Fire Upon the Deep and Doomsday Book tied, because they were both books that I liked but didn't love, but they were probably the two that from that year that didn't really, make me go, eh. I'd also like to point out, when you mentioned the 80s, the 80s began with 1980, which is when Fountains of Paradise won. You may remember Fountains of Paradise was supposed to be Clark's last book. He had spent about a year talking about the fact that he was going to retire at that point, and it beat out Titan, and it beat out Gem, and it beat out Wings of Song by Thomas Dish.
Tempest on the Wind, yeah.
Yeah, and one has to wonder if how much of that was sentimentality, Not that there's anything necessarily wrong with that. I'm just, the other legitimate tool that they serve is that they are a wonderful filter for hindsight.
Right.
Okay. Well, for me, I was just amazed. We will put this link in the show notes. But Locus has a wonderful resource of not only the Hugos and the Nebulas, but World Fantasy, Sifwa Grandmaster, Hall of Fame, mm-hmm. Andre Norton, British Fantasy, British SF, Campbell Memorial, Chesley Clark, IFA, PKD, Ray Browery. I mean, it just goes on and on. I cannot believe how many awards are given out in fandom at this point.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's part of the problem, is that, you know, people complain about whoever has won, but fandom is really fractured a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it used to be the Hugo, you put that on your book cover, you won. That was like a guarantee of X number of sales or whatever. But now, does it have as much impact as it used to? Have we become too diffuse and too unfocused, even?
Or have we just become much more diverse?
Yeah.
I mean, see, for me, I think it's a good thing to have more awards. Partly because I'm not a big sort of prestige or community unification kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like the variety. I think it can lead to that kind of fracturing that you're talking about. But I think given the output, the increase in output over the years, like could one award really, or even two or three awards, could it really capture, you know, the literary output in any way for a given year?
Yeah.
In the genre.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think so. I mean, like I said, as ambivalent as I'm about awards, like I said, they do serve some useful purposes. And I think one of those is to give you that sort of range of the production of literature in the genre for a given year. So I kind of like the diversity. I don't think we need any more awards, I don't think, but I think we're good for the most part.
Fred, I'd like
but
to...
I like the range.
Fred, I'd like to make a prediction right now, and that is that if our dear Mr. Stevens ever does win a Hugo for Fan Writer, he will be insufferable. There will be no talking to him whatsoever.
No, I'm predicting that he is going to win not the Hugo, but the Wooden Rocket. Which is not quite at the end of the list, but pretty...
Yeah. It's funny that you say that, John, because as a almost lifelong libertarian, I always pay attention to the Prometheus Awards, and I always get so utterly pissed off every time I read the nominations every year, because I go, are you kidding me? These are the books that got chosen? Come on. There are better libertarian books written by downright socialist writers that managed to capture it a little better than some of the stuff that right. wins that award. So yeah, so they do create a sense of irritation if one, you know, imbues too much significance into them, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's not to take away from any Hugo winners that we may know personally or happen to be great fans of, and on speaking terms with on Twitter, etc.
All right, to bring this around to the end, the one thing I'd like to love to see is the Sifwa Grandmasters or the Damon Knight Memorial Grandmaster Award. I wish Sifwa would open it up to more than one person a year, because there's a lot of people that should get that award that are getting older and older, and that award ought to be given to them while they're still around to enjoy it. And I'd love to see, for example, maybe Rosemary Sutcliffe or Mary Stewart win.
Mm.
Right.
I mean, you look at all the Arthurian romances and fantasies that have been published. Those two were the pioneers, among others.
How same argument could be made for Chelsea Quinn Yarborough.
Yes. Yep.
Sure.
Who you know,
invented the vampire.
Not just that, but who clearly deserves you know, recognition at least one order of magnitude greater than already has.
Yep.
Right.
So that's my editorial comment. More memorial Grandmaster awards, please.
My last thought concerning the Hugo Awards is that as I'm going through this, going through the list of the winners and nominees, and I was just thinking back fondly to the mid '80s when Orson Scott Card could do no wrong. So,
yes.
The young people may not think that was ever a time, but it really was. It really, really was.
Yes, it was. Okay, for the second part of our show tonight, we're going to revisit a subject from our last episode. And those that downloaded and listened may recall that we were much amused at a Reddit thread that talked about classic SF books that you really shouldn't have to read. And the reason I'm amused is that I discovered a FlavorWire article, 50 sci-fi and fantasy novels that everyone should read, and clocking in at number 5 of the 50 was one of the top nominees of books you shouldn't read, namely Dahlgren by Samuel R. Delaney.
Yep.
But it's
and what have we learned today?
Yeah.
That Orson Scott Card is also on this list.
Yes.
We'll of course post a link, but it's just bizarre to go from one portion of the internet to another. You should not. Did any of the other titles strike anybody or of interest?
Well, go ahead, Jeff.
That list almost felt a bit formula because most of what was in there was. Mm-hmm. There were a few obscure and left field books that were in there, but all in all, not that many. And you know, it was great to see Octavia Butler listed, and it was great to see Susanna Clark listed. I like Vonnegut. Does Slaughterhouse-Five need to be on every list of you know? You're not really missing a vital section of science fiction if you skip Slaughterhouse-Five in my book. You know, that's right. Just my opinion.
Well, there's so many other books of his you could recommend. I mean, like like Hugo, for example.
Yeah. it seemed to, the list almost looked like it was going out of its way to be not just inclusive of a lot of books that are considered classic and a lot of books that are fan favorites, but also to be
literary
and literary. Yes, there was, but even then it didn't really, you know, jump too far into the literary vein, quite frankly. And there was a few books on there that I mean, among others by Joe Walton. Yeah, I was so happy to see that on the list because it does, you know, it certainly belongs there. I thought it was much more interesting, the actual editions of the books that they showed on the list, because that cover to Andre Norton's Witch World just makes me laugh out loud every time.
Oh, yes. Yes.
That is such a beautiful piece of work.
Uh-huh.
It's the... It's like the prequel to Battle of the Planets, the cartoon or something. So.
Yeah.
And Little Big was on there, which did not win a Hugo Award. So.
I think I agree that in large measure it's very by the numbers. And the stuff that they chose that wasn't, I looked at and thought, sure. But, you know, like, for example, about Colson Whitehead 01 was an interesting edition.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that's, you know, essential. It's a good book. I've read it. It's good. But it doesn't have that essential feeling that a lot of these other books have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was really pleased to see Neil Hopkinson in there with Wrong Girl in the Ring. That's a great book. That's one that I would love to talk to people about when they're looking for something out of the sort of off the main track in terms of really strong reads. And then there was, you know, Never Let Me Go by Ishiguro, which is, again, it didn't really feel like an essential book.
Right.
It's good, but I think there are other books that do what his book does, that are more, you know, interesting. So it was in a large measure by the numbers, and then there were a few surprises in terms of what was included. And then there were a lot of surprises in what wasn't included.
Right.
You know, Stan Robinson. You know, I mean, well, you could actually make quite a long list because there's only 50 books.
Right.
So no list of 50, and this is sort of goes back to that, you know, the sort of the breadth of the field. There's no way a 50 book list will really give you all the essentials. You know, you'll get an interesting insight into the field, but it's interesting to me to look at the range of books and actually see. It says 50 sci-fi slash fantasy, but it's hugely sci-fi. There's not a lot of fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
There's literally a handful of fantasy books in here.
Yeah.
And they don't even really hint at the breadth of that part of the field, really.
That's pretty standard.
It's all very, very standard, like the fantasy stuff. Except for, you know, Susanna Clarke is sort of a more recent addition that's a great book.
Well, I would love to see someone's head explode reading first the C.S. Lewis title and then going to Philip Pullman.
Yeah.
And, you know, with C.S. Lewis, they recommended one of the books in the series. With Pullman, they recommended the whole series.
Yeah.
Essentially.
But, like, the Discworld title was not, I don't think that's one of his better titles.
No.
Well, that's another thing. You can look at this stuff and, like I said, that's... Like that other list, there's a lot you can look at and say, really? Is that really? But again, like a lot of lists online, there's a couple things. It's just a template that someone came up with.
Yeah, and that's...
That is very subjective.
Right. And that to me, I mean... I think about a book like... And once again, I'm filtering this through my own experience, you know? I mean, I think about, you know, Songs by Distant Earth by Clark, or I think of, yeah, it's nice to have Frankenstein on there, but I think someone's going to get much more of a visceral experience if they read Frankenstein Unbound by Brian Aldiss, you know? And yes. Light of Other Days by Clark and Baxter, or Spin by Robert Charles Wilson, which I think is probably one of the most accessible science fiction books to someone that has never, mm-hmm. never touched on it.
Sure.
And even more contemporary people, Robert Reed and Eric Brown and Peter F. Hamilton and stuff like that for people that if I'm just thinking of a list of things that's being aimed at someone that may not have delved into SF as deeply as they might, you know, want to. Quite frankly, what I'd really like to see and what I may have to do now that I've thought of it is do a similar list of anthologies. There's been so many themed mm-hmm. anthologies that have come out, as well as, you know, leaving out the best ofs that come out every year and stuff like that. There's been so many great
sure.
original anthologies throughout the history of SF, but in the last 10 years, and I think about all those, you know, those themed DAW books that Martin Greenberg always had his hand in. There's just so many of them that has, you know, so many really nice examples of what was going on at the genre at that time, and I think it would be a really good barometer to, you know, and even more recent ones like Armored and stuff like that, and the Solaris anthologies are definitely, I think, would be good for business for the genre in my book.
If we only knew of a site where you could post such a list.
Yeah, Jeff. I know. I got to think. I really got to think of a place where we could do it. The only one I can think of has the bad taste to have us on, so I don't know if we want to trust them. So.
Yeah, maybe IO9.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, it was nice to see Dahlgren appear on two diverse lists, one after the other. You know, if nothing else, maybe we'll get people to read it some more.
So our recommendation is that you either read it or not read it.
Right, true. That's true. All right, now, before we wrap up with our culture consumed, to steal a line from Galactic Suburbia, I thought we could talk a little bit about, what I basically call no battle plan survives contact with the enemy. And I kind of started this a couple of years ago when actually John DiNardo of SF Signal started posting. He was trying to read 365 short stories in a year. Yep. So I started keeping track of how many short stories I read, and then I started keeping track of how many books I read. I would post it on my site. A couple of times I've tried to actually develop a reading plan for the year, and that usually doesn't last past, you know, if I the next hot book I pick up, or I get, I mean, it's, you know, like the movie Up, where they always yell squirrel at the dogs. That's me. Throw a book and off I go. So, any thoughts?
Yeah, I had a couple. I did not go into this year with a plan except to read more than I did last year. I've read a lot more short stuff that I read this year. I've tried to do most of the digests and anthologies cover to cover when I can. Now that I'm in Virginia and have a much shorter commute, I really haven't gotten through as much audio books as I would have liked to, unlike 3 years ago when I had a two-hour commute on a good day. And the other thing that came to mind when you said that was how easily, I mean, I will make myself a nice little stack of 10 books and go, yep, that doesn't look like that big of a pile. I can go through that. And then something happens, like, as I mentioned in the last episode, discovering a writer like Matthew Hughes or something like that, that throws that entire plan right off. Suddenly I go, okay, I need to be much more knowledged in this particular corner of what's going on. Or the other thing that will happen is I find myself compelled through either nostalgia or good memories or a reference that I see somewhere else to go pick up something like the entire Cornelius Chronicles by Moorcock and read the entire thing cover to cover. And I you know, once in a while I'll find myself a really nice short book at a used bookstore and I go, yeah, this will do me. And I open it up and I forget that people in the 60s and 70s had much larger eyes because they had such small print in those books. And this nice little 120-page book actually contains an exceedingly high number of words. And I need my stronger glasses to get through them.
Right.
So I tend to, my eyes tend to be bigger than my stomach or brain in this case when it comes to getting through it. But for the most part, I really didn't go into it. One thing I did try to do this year, and I kind of have the two of you and several other people at SF Signal to think about, was to really kind of widen my net when it came to the stuff that I was reading. There were a few books by authors that I'm not huge fans of that I said, okay, I'll try this. This is getting some buzz. And on one occasion, yeah, it was pretty good. On other occasions, I was like, nope, this is the same stuff I've been reading by this person. And the other thing that I really tried to get involved in is I had a very bad habit of reading short stories in the digests and not really noting how many stories by a given writer I had read. There are certain ones like David Levine and Robert Reed who I will automatically read when I get the book, but I started noting the stories that I was really enjoying and making notes of their names and going back and seeing if I had other stories by things. And sure enough, I am fans of short story writers that I wasn't aware that I was a fan of.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that kind of hit me like a truck this year as well. So I am retrenching and retooling for the last third of the year. So.
How about you, John?
Well, here's my problem.
You work in a bookstore.
I do work in a bookstore. That's not a problem so much as I don't know what to call it.
It's a condition.
It's a condition. That's very good. But the thing with me and reading is I read on three tracks. I read for the book I'm writing on reading. I read for reviews, and then I have, you know, pleasure reading. And that means that if I if I don't coordinate carefully, I'm reading five or six things at a time and not making a huge amount of progress. And, you know, that happens a lot because I tend to, my penchant for organization sort of waxes and wanes like a lunar cycle. So, you know, like, you know, but what I try to do is I try to do that. I try to have each of these tracks. And of course, each one is complicated by the purpose. So for the book, I take copious notes. You know, I'm actually writing often as I read, inserting things into chapters and changing things and taking a break from the reading to pursue a thought, et cetera. So it's very, it's a very unreaderly experience. Because I'm generally mining the material for information that I am then going to use in writing. For reviews, I take notes, sometimes on paper, sometimes on the laptop or the notebook as I'm going along. But there, it's not the same kind of thing, because I'm not mining the book. I'm trying to experience the book and trying to translate my experience of reading the book. Mm. So there's more stretches of reading and there's less writing. Like, I try not to stop when reading for a book for review and try to write. I try to just keep reading because I'm trying to be as, you know, thorough a reader as possible. And then pleasure reading, you know, which I don't do a lot of at the moment, unfortunately. But I mean, for pleasure reading, it's, very specifically, I don't do any of that. There's no note taking, or I mean, occasionally I might go jot something down on the computer or something, but that's an attempt to actually be just a reader, which is really hard for me actually.
You know, something else I started doing this year is that if I know I have to leave in half an hour and go do something, I will not resume my novel reading. I find that I've got to give myself an hour minimum, if not preferably 2 or 3 hours to sit down. And reading to me has become a session. I have to prep it. I have to, you know, dust the chair off, fill my glass. You know. And now that we've actually got some decent weather down here, hopefully this weekend I'm going to be able to go sit on the back patio and read out there, which was last year one of my favorite things to do down here. So.
Well, the one thing that's changed for me, oddly enough, with an e-reader is that I'm doing a lot more, quote-unquote, underlining, even when I'm reading for pleasure, and sending them out as a tweet, because I just keep hoping that somebody will pick up on what I'm tweeting about and pick up the book.
Right.
And I think it's worked a couple times.
Yeah, it has.
All right. Let's move on to culture consumed. Who would like to
culture
discuss what they've read or viewed or listened to since the last episode?
Okay, I'll go first. Why not? Well, on track one, for non-pleasure reading, I was on a neuroscience kick for the reading book for several weeks.
I remember that.
And now I'm a little disenchanted with neuroscience, because I've read a lot of it now and I'm beginning to understand it and I'm beginning to see the problems. So I've actually shifted to looking more at the psychology of reading. Mm. So I've been reading like work by Daniel Gilbert and his experiments. And going back up with some other stuff by people like Keith Oatley, and other psychologists who are trying to study what reading does for people. I've got a couple of books I'm reading for review. Although actually I'm actually waiting for a couple of more books to come. I kind of have a break in my review queue at the moment. But I have a long overdue review of the book about Ray Bradbury in his early years to write. So I've been rereading parts of that for the review. And then for pleasure reading, I am slogging through The Vor by Brian Catling, which is in some ways a terrific book and kind of an awe-inspiring book. and in a few other kind of important ways, a really irritating book. It's a fantasy book. It's extremely ambitious. It is often very self-consciously artistic. And one of the things that gets me, and this kind of surprises me, because I often go back and forth on, you know, what characters need to do in a story. But the thing that kind of bugs me, that I keep tripping up against, is the characters are fascinating constructs for the narrative, but they're not very fascinating characters.
Mm.
There's a very high level of functionality and a very low level of humanity for my money. That varies. There are some characters that are better than others, but in some ways it's a really amazing book. I mean, the writing is very self-assured. The world building is very fluid. And it's very odd. It's a very strange setting, but it's got a certain familiarity. So he does a great job of tacking between the uncanny and the familiar. And it's fascinating to read. And I actually, you know, I'm someone who can usually march through the densest text without having to slow down. But I am actually stopping and going back over stuff sometimes. Not because the prose is truncated or overly, you know, verbose, but because I'm trying to get more clarity and understand what's going on better. So it's an interesting book, and I think it's one that I would recommend that people read. But I think it's one that may also frustrate some readers, particularly if you're someone who likes sort of, you know, really character-focused writing.
Mm.
That's me.
Jeff?
Our dear friend, the intrepid Paul Weimer, had asked me to participate in a mind meld last month or the month before on SF Signal. And the subject was Beyond 1984, and it was books about despotism and erosion of freedoms and dystopian fiction in general. And one of the stories that I had talked about in there was The Liberation of Earth by William Tenn, a story I had always loved. And the only copy of it I could find was in a anthology called The Survival of Freedom that was edited by Jerry Pournelle. And it came out, let me check what year this came out real quick. This was 78, this came out.
Yep.
It was put out by Fawcett Books. And it was called The Survival of Freedom, and it was basically a anthology of predominantly science fiction stories of various shades of hardness and softness. Involving the concept of liberty and how it is approached and how it is viewed, etc. And it's a lot. I believe it's all reprints. I'm not certain if there was anything new for it. And there's a lot of classics in there. There's Repent, Harlequin, and The Jigsaw Man, and what was the other one I hadn't read in a while here? Dodkin's Job by Jack Vance, which I had not read in many years. And I read most of it. I think there's like two or three I still haven't read yet, but I read it and it was very interesting because Pournell does a lot of forwarding on it, and he's number one, he's very harsh on libertarianism, and then goes on to give a number of examples where government interference has really messed up his life, which I kind of chuckled at. But number two, it was very I talked about, you know, the filter of the past and hindsight, and there was a lot of it to be seen in here, because when you look at the view, so many of the stories were reflecting what the authors thought was either happening, or they were doing metaphors of what they thought was happening in the world and in the U.S. and stuff like that. And it was, I had a few moments of, wow, we really have managed to come pretty far, you know, for all the complaints that we make and stuff like that, and all the things that are genuinely wrong and broken with our current society. There was a few things that were brought up in this book that I had really opened my eyes to some stuff that people thought may have been inevitable threats and stuff like that. There's one story, I forget the name of it, that all has to do with automating the voting system, which is just I actually found myself chuckling out loud, given how many, you know, horrible elections that we've seen. That's one of them. It was an anthology that I had kind of forgotten about until I went looking for that William Ten story. I'm also going to throw out two comics. Number one, Jeff Lemire, the first issue of his new comic Trillium is out. Trillium is put out by Vertigo Books. It has a very heavy metal-ish feel when it comes to the way Jeff Lemire has drawn in, and he colors it, and a few other people work on the colors as well. And it is a flip book. There are two stories in it, and the two stories kind of meet in the middle. And one of the stories is about a guy who is fed up after the war and decides to pick up a mentor of his dream to find a lost Incan temple of gold, and runs into all kinds of trouble while he goes down there. And the other story is about a young woman who is part of a colony that is trying to make contact with this group of aliens that lives on the planet, because these aliens have a plant which can fight this horrible plague called the Call, which is destroying humanity planet after planet. And knowing that the Call is making its way to this colony, the young woman decides to throw caution to the wind and really push on making contact and interpreting their language. And it's got a very classic boilerplate science fiction feel to it. It is by no means, you know, full-blown hard science fiction, but it's not delving into, you know, transhumanism. It's not delving into, you know, postmodern technologies and stuff like that. It really pretty much is classic. We flew to this planet in a ship, and we landed here, and now we've got to deal with the natives, etc. And these two stories meet dead center in the middle of the book. And it was a very surprising little read. I'm really enjoying it. I'm looking forward to what's going to happen next. It's a very unique book on the comic landscape right now as well. And the other one I have to throw out, I'm going to go to the other end of the spectrum and go very lowbrow. There is currently a miniseries coming out right now called Godzilla Rulers of the Earth, which is one of the several really good Godzilla comics that have been coming out in the last couple of years. This one has to do with it's a relatively typical formulaic plot where the aliens are trying to get all the monsters to wipe out humanity, et cetera, et cetera. We've been there before. The second issue, which came out a couple of weeks ago, is quite humorous in the fact that the monster that Godzilla ends up fighting is the Godzilla from the American Godzilla movie a few years ago. The two of them have a very short battle in Godzilla Final Wars, the last of the Toho Godzilla films a while ago. This comic actually gives, and that fight only lasted about 6 seconds. This, they get to go at it for several pages, and there are shout outs to both the classic Godzilla movie and the American one. It was very enjoyable. And the fact that the artist can really convey personality in two monsters, you know, basically swinging their tails at one another is really impressive. And it's probably the book that made me smile the most the last couple of weeks.
Cool.
And issue 13 of Saga came out. Saga is back from its second hiatus. So.
Well, for me, I subscribed to yet another magazine today. And this was due to the two-part Crossing the Gulf episodes on SF Signal that Karen Burnham and Karen Lord were discussing Cordwainer Smith. And after I was heard it, I got into a Twitter conversation with Karen Lord, which ended with Gary Wolf chiming in, suggesting that I look at SF studies, science fiction studies, which in the current issue has a article called Alpha Ralpha Boulevard talking about Cordwainer Smith. So I have now subscribed, and I will download to my heart's content as many back issues as I can grab, and probably come up with 6 million more books than I want to buy. But That's typical.
Yes. And yes.
At a certain point, you just got to admit there's a problem, man. You know.
Yes. So. Now, what I'm reading with great pleasure right now is Fritz Leiber, The Ghost Light, which was one of the first entries in Byron Price's masterworks of science fiction and fantasy. And it's a combination of both some of his best short work, but also a rather long section of autobiographical writing. And this one has some wonderful stories, such as Four Ghosts in Hamlet, which was particularly good for me because I got my daughter to read it. She was just starred in her award-winning run on not even quite off-Broadway, being Polonius in the Summer Shakespeare.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yes, so she enjoyed the story, but it also contains classics like Gonna Roll the Bones.
Yeah,
and Bazaar of the Bazaar, which is a Fafford and Gray Mouser story, and Midnight by the Morphy Watch, which is a story about chess. I mean, of all of Leiber's short works, the only one that is missing, in my opinion, from this collection, which would make it perfect for me, is Catch That Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm.
But the book's got its wonderful illustrations. It has a picture of Leiber in front of a bookstore, which they decorated with many of the illustrations. It has one story original to the collection, The Ghost Light, and it's got this wonderful autobiographical section called Not Much Disorder and Not So Early Sex, an autobiographical essay. So that's my recommendation and what I'm reading. And to bring this to our future episodes, I'm also reading Nova by Samuel R. Delaney.
Yeah.
And just to let you folks in on what we're going to do is, I put up a big list of books that I thought would be interesting to talk about. And we've picked our first three titles. Over the next several months, we'll look at each of these books. The first one being Nova by Samuel R. Delaney, which was quite the thing when it was first published.
Oh, and it's
still, I think, quite the thing. And just to give you a taste of how quite the thing it was, Algis Budrys in Galaxy says, right now, as of this book, Nova, not as of some future book or some accumulated body of work, is the best, he's talking about Delaney, is the best science fiction writer in the world at a time when competition for that status is intense. So I'm enjoying my reread, and it'll be interesting to see what everyone else says when we get around to that, early next month.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Looking forward to it.
So, gentlemen, I thank you again for joining us up in the balcony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, and thank you all for listening, and hope to hear some comments when we post this, and look forward to next month.
And I hope to meeting some of you at WorldCon, if possible.
That's true.
Excellent.
Or John's bookstore. You can always hang out there.
Yeah, it's true.
Come on down, y'all.
I need a road trip anyway, so.
Yep. All right, thank you, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.